of energy. People have a lot of trouble with that. Signals bouncing back and forth. Are they real or is it reactive? From A2VDH. Thank you for bringing this to our attention, John. And how comfortable do you feel on the subject of standing wave ratio? I think I know the answer. We all have a little bit of discomfort with it. WA2VDH. K2RIW in the tech net.
Well, yeah, you do raise a good point, Dick. The whole concept of phase shift, that is another whole can of worms that can generate a lot of confusion. I know a lot of people confuse phase shift with time delay, and that can cause confusion because people think of a phase lag or a phase lead, then try to tie that in with time shift. You think, well, is it a time lead? And it's not. That can really cause quite a bit of confusion. But as I say, it's a fascinating article, and he does address that concept of the antenna tuner re-reflecting the power, and goes into the points of really why that can be an erroneous viewpoint. Anyway, I'll turn it back to Ned. I'm sure there's others waiting. So thanks again, Dick, for the comments. Appreciate it.
Believe it or not, John, there are a considerable number of situations where time shift and lead and lag, phase shift, lead and lag, are directly related. If I took a single generator, put it into a T connector, and out of the two arms of the T connector, I have equal length of transmission line going into a dual channel oscilloscope that's fast enough to show the RF waveform. So now I've got two sine waves on the oscilloscope, one above the other, directly in phase with each other, identical to each other, except one is shifted vertically compared to the other. Those two signals are in phase. I now take the lower signal, that particular coax cable coming out of the T connector, and I substitute a longer piece of coax, because the signal has to go through a longer piece of coax to get to that lower trace. It is arriving late in time. On the oscilloscope screen, you'll see that waveform shifted to the right. It has now got a lagging phase because it arrived later. So the amount of phase shift and the time delay are exactly equal to each other in that example. Or correspondingly, if I shortened the upper one instead, the signal would be arriving earlier. It would be shifted to the left. So time delay and phase shift in examples like that do have a one-to-one relationship. Even though they came from the same source, they arrive at the two channels of the oscilloscope at slightly different periods of time, and the different periods of time shows up as a very calculatable amount of phase shift in degrees or nanoseconds, if you like. Over to you for a comment on that one, John.
Repeater, timeout.
WA2VDH, wait for the beeps, I didn't. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
That's fine business, Dick. But if you added, let's say, 9/10 of a wavelength difference on one of the lines, now that 9/10 of a wavelength would phase delay you, what, 0.9 times 360 degrees, which you would probably view as a phase leading of the situation. Go ahead.
No. If I added 9/10 of a wavelength of cable, 9/10 of a wavelength in the velocity factor of that cable represents some number of feet of cable. About 9/10 of a wavelength would be 324 degrees of lag. 324 degrees of lag, because phase repeats every 360, you would see it on the scope as 324 away from 360. I think I would be able to calculate that real fast. You would see it as 36 degrees of lead. You really were, undo this, it really was 324 degrees of lag. So, with 324 degrees of phase shift, is it 324 degrees of lag, or is it 36 degrees of lead? The answer is yes and yes. It's a matter of your viewpoint, because of the way phase repeats. Now, let me drop. I'm only looking at the sine wave on an oscilloscope in order to make that 324 degrees of lag or 36 degrees of lead measurement. If I now had some kind of an exact timing device, if I put out a square wave and I'm measuring the instant of rise time of the square wave, now I would see the 9/10 of a wavelength is going to be some number of nanoseconds or microseconds, and now I would know exactly is it lag or lead. But if I'm looking at a repetitive sine wave, in one case I'm looking at sine wave number 541 on the top, and I'm looking at sine wave number 542 on the bottom that has been delayed, or vice versa, you know what I mean. Because of the sine wave repeating, I can't easily tell the difference between 326 lag, or 324 lag, or 36 lead. But if I was doing exact timing with something that's non-repetitive, like a square wave, a pulse, I could resolve that. So in many cases, there's an exact relationship between the length of transmission line, time delay of arrival of the signal, and what we call phase shift of the signal that you read. A little bit complicated, but there's ways of putting it all back together there, John. W-H-2-V-D-H, K-2-L-I-W in the TechNet.
Actually, Dick, I don't think you can talk about a phase shift if you have a non-sinusoidal waveform. We speak of a phase of relative to a sine wave. If we have a pulse, then we're pretty much talking about a time delay. Phase is an inherently sine wave characteristic because it comes from the circular function, the circle that the sine wave is generated from. As another example, if we talk about, say, a sine wave that starts at time equals zero, and we run that into a 45-degree leading RC network, when the sine wave starts at time equals zero, we're not going to see the sine wave 45 degrees ahead coming out because there's no signal coming in at that time. We don't see it settle down and give that 45-degree lead until the transient part has died out. So, again, this is why you have to be really careful with phase. Go ahead.
I just about 99% agree with everything you said, John, with one slight exception. In the case of a pulsed waveform, and I'm measuring time delay in nanoseconds or microseconds because one cable is longer than the other. I got a T connector, two lengths of cable going into a dual chase scope. And if it's a video pulse, I can easily measure the time delay in nanoseconds, and you and I don't call it phase shift, because we don't talk about phase shift or pulses per se. However, if the waveform is a pulse of an RF signal, like a radar signal, so inside of that video outer envelope is a whole bunch of sine waves of the actual RF frequency of the pulse. Now, of the RF frequency that's inside of the pulse, with a certain amount of time delay, I could convert that back into phase shift of that sine wave inside the pulse. So even on a pulse waveform, in some cases, I could talk about phase shift. That's a fairly prevalent situation because every radar does that. The radar has got an envelope that is a pulse, but inside the envelope is an RF waveform. And you delay that pulse, you're really delaying when that RF waveform arrives. You could, if you want to, call the phase shift. The cyclic phase shift you get from pulses when it's coming from a moving aircraft, and you and I call it Doppler shift. Let me drop. We call it Doppler shift. If the airplane is coming toward you, the RF signal inside of each one of those pulses will appear to be higher in frequency. We call it a Doppler shift because of an approaching moving vehicle that's doing the emitting. What is the higher frequency? Frequency is the rate of changing phase. So that pulse of the aircraft approaching you, the sine wave of RF energy inside of those pulses is advancing in phase continuously because the aircraft is continuously coming toward you. The path length between you and it is continuously getting shorter. So that is a continuous phase shift, you and I call it higher frequency. We call it Doppler frequency shift because of velocity. Ain't that crazy? WHUVDH, KQRIW and the Tech Man.
But as far, I agree with that, yeah, and it, but as far as the whole envelope of the pulse, isn't that referred to as the group delay? Go ahead.
Absolutely. So the whole pulse has got a group delay. Inside the pulse is a sine wave. When it arrives earlier, I could measure the phase angle of that sine wave, reference to some other reference sine wave, or I could recognize the fact that the sine wave inside is continuously advancing in phase because the eckred is coming toward me. The group delay of the pulses arriving to me is also getting shorter and shorter. Group delay time in microseconds from some reference of when he transmitted the pulse from that airplane that's approaching me and when I receive it, the whole group delay is getting smaller and smaller because he's getting closer and closer. The fact that the signal going through air has a very predictable, roughly 300 million meters per second of speed, velocity, I can use that reference to measure range. That's one of the very nice things about a radar. It can, in many cases, allow you to extremely accurately measure range and range rate. How fast is he moving? W2VDH, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hi, this is Dick. Yeah, very informative. I really appreciate your comments. And, as I said, I took notes, so I really appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to turn it back to Ned. I just wanted to, again, recommend those articles by Stephen Best in that 2001 QEX, and because I know the questions have come up quite a few times on the tech net. So back to you, Dick, and let you move on to the next person on the net. Okay, once again, thanks for the comments.
Of all the radars that are out there that are doing surveillance and recognition of where the aircraft are for landing pattern control and stuff like that, most of those radars are putting out a pulse that's somewhere between 1 and 10 or 1 and 20 microseconds of pulse lit. And the pulses come at the 300 pulses per second, 1,000 pulses per second, 5,000 pulses per second. So every radar has a certain pulse duration and a pulse rep rate. Then the next question is, how far can you push that? The first time in 1990 that I proposed building a radar-like device where each individual pulse was not a microsecond long, not a nanosecond long, I was going to make each pulse a quarter of a nanosecond long. That's really pushing it. And since the carrier is going to be at roughly 10 gigahertz, each individual pulse consisted of a three-cycle waveform at 10 gigahertz, a little bit less than three cycles. I was operating a little bit more than 10 gigahertz, but a quarter of a nanosecond pulse, where each pulse comes on for three cycles and then goes off. And I was transmitting a million pulses per second. That's really pushing the state-of-the-art of radars. When I first proposed doing that, various people told me, you can't do that. It won't work. To which I said, why not? And the answers I got, of course, were vague. The bottom line, of course, I did do it. It was an extremely short-range radar. It was used as a diagnostic tool inside of the anechoic chamber, which is now called the Benningfield anechoic chamber at Edwards Air Force Base near Camarillo, California. Let me drop. No, it's not Camarillo. Or is it? Nope, not. Can't think of the name of the nearest local town. It'll come to me in a minute. Anyhow, that so-called radar allowed me to look inside the chamber and find all of the echoing devices that shouldn't be there. That so-called radar only had 300 feet of range maximum, but it could resolve things to the nearest third of a foot. Every third of a foot I could find an echo in that chamber if there was one there, and tell you in which direction and how many feet away from the radar in the center. So we used that as a diagnostic tool to find out where were the nails and adapters that had been dropped into the anechoic material, into the pyramids on the floor, and were giving them phony echoes. before instance. So what's the briefest pulses you've ever heard out of a radar? In my case, with a RF radar, a third of a nanosecond. You can read articles about, let me drop it, about people using very fast laser devices where they're making optical pulses picoseconds and femtoseconds and sub-femtoseconds long. The pulse is so short that when you do it repetitively and use the right kind of visualizing device, you can actually see the pulse itself going through the medium. You can see the leading edge and the trailing edge of the pulse when using the right kind of visualizing device from a very fast, laser device. A nice rule of thumb is the speed of light in air is very close to a nanosecond per foot. If your pulse is a nanosecond long, from the leading edge to the trailing edge of the pulse, if you could see it, would be 1 foot long, 1 foot from front to back. A quarter of a nanosecond is a quarter of a foot. A picosecond is, I think it's a tenth of an inch. A picosecond is a tenth of an inch. Rough rule of thumb. And these are real. These measurements can be made, have been made, and under the right conditions, they're very useful. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call at us right now, K2IW in the TechNet.
With a 250 picosecond pulse like that, wouldn't the bandwidth be extremely wide? Did you have to have a very wide band antenna in that? Go ahead.
Give that man a cigar. A quarter of a nanosecond pulse, in theory, is more than 4 gigahertz wide. 1 nanosecond would be 1 gig wide. The antenna doing the radiating, the mixer that was generating the pulses, and all of the equipment connected to it, had to be more than 4 gigahertz wide in order to properly reproduce that pulse without rounding out the corners, if you know what I mean. I'm trying to remember what we used as an antenna. I think it was a Vivaldi antenna, yes. A very broadband antenna. A Vivaldi antenna was doing the radiating and the reception. And when it comes to receiving a quarter of a nanosecond pulse, you don't just put that pulse into a radar receiver, which has got a mixer front end, RF amplifier, an IF strip and whatever, and then a detector. A crystal detector cannot detect a pulse of a quarter of a nanosecond. The fastest crystal detectors you can buy have a rise time of around 3 nanoseconds. I was creating pulses that were 12 times faster than that. The only way I could detect that pulse is with a sampling oscilloscope. Didn't detect the pulse at all. Didn't rectify the pulse at all. Looked at the direct RF waveform with a sampling oscilloscope that could go to 20 gigahertz. It was a Hewlett-Packard 54120, as I remember, sampling oscilloscope. So I was looking at the waveform of the pulse directly as a receiving technique displayed on the sampling oscilloscope screen. I wasn't looking at the envelope of the pulse. I was looking at the RF energy inside of the pulse as a display device. Because you can't make crystal detectors that fast. Over to you, John, K2LIW in the TechNet.
That's a fascinating piece of equipment you built. That's amazing. That's a very interesting topic. Okay, I'll let you go on to the next person, Dick. Appreciate all the comments.
Yeah, the people at the Anacard chamber had a bunch of echoes. They didn't know where they were coming from. A bunch of phony echoes in the chamber. The Anacard chamber wasn't anechoic. They had spent 6 months looking for the echoes, couldn't find them. And when they finally found them, what a surprise it was. I came along and made these proposals as to how to build test equipment to find them. Various people told me, you're crazy, it can't work. You'll never get any response out of that thing. When it started working, those exact same people who said it can't possibly work said I always knew it was a good idea. It taught me a lot about human nature. And I won a number of awards for that particular work, and the chamber became a very effective chamber once the echoes were removed. In that particular case, the undesired echoes were coming from the anechoic material itself that was on the floor. But that's another whole story. Okay, we've only had 3 people who signed in. Is anyone else that wants to sign in late with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and TechNet.
Here you
go. Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I did a little looking up and reminding myself. There was at one time 5 different competing AM radio systems, the stereo. They were done by, the one that you were trying to think of was Leonard Kahn, and he was with Hazelton. There was a system that was developed by Harris, and a system developed by Magnavox. Motorola had their Sequam system, which is actually the system that's in use today. And there was another system developed by Bel Air, and they all operated in different manners.
So I'm guessing that temporary assignments were made by the FCC. Temporary authority was issued where various people were able to test these stereo systems over the air. So for a short period of time, there probably were a couple of stereo systems being tested. I'm guessing they all had their glitches. But of the Motorola system, if I understand correctly, is what they settled on. What percentage of the AM broadcast stations today are transmitting stereo by the Motorola system? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, this that I'm looking at is a couple of years old. At that point, it was 92 stations.
92 stations. Is that like 20% of all the stations in the U.S.?
Probably a little bit more at this point, because there has been a reduction of AM broadcasting, as you may be well aware.
What's your guess as to the total number of AM broadcast stations in the continental United States?
Oh, I could look that up and be exact, but I suspect it's in the maybe 300, 400, 500, something like that.
Close enough. So maybe 20 or 25% are transmitting stereo, and now the FCC approved stereo system is one system, and so except for some special temporary authority experiments that might be run, there's only one stereo system right now. And do almost all of the radios that are in automobiles today, are they properly equipped to hear that particular stereo? I'm guessing the answer is yes. I've got stereo in my car. I'm guessing that's how it works. Over to you, Eric.
Oh, I wouldn't go as far as say every radio is capable of stereo. Generally, when you go and you buy your car, they'll get either a plain old stereo FM, AM radio, or you can ask for an HD radio, which is the current system. The Sequam actually, in the late 90s, became part of what's now known as iBox. The reason for that is the Sequam is really a 16-QAM type of transmission. And the audio portion of it today is MPEG, whereas in the original format was just PCM.
The Sequam technique has some kind of a subcarrier rate. Is that subcarrier rate something like 50 kilohertz on FM, Eric? Go ahead.
What you're probably thinking of is the AM system has a pilot that runs at 25 hertz. It's a little bit different in the FM world.
Okay, the pilot's at 25 hertz. But what roughly is the sampling rate of the stereo that's being transmitted?
The actual data rate is somewhere around 9600 baud, but when you do it via MPEG, you can get some pretty good bandwidth. Oh, by the way, since the adoption of Sequam on AM, it used to be the AM stations were 20 kilohertz wide, now they're only 10 kilohertz wide.
Roughly how long ago did they switch from 20 to 10? And were all the stations roughly 20 kilohertz apart at one time, and now they're only 10 kilohertz apart?
Channel spacing is the same, because you need the bandwidth to contain both signals.
What is the channel spacing? I should know, but I don't.
Actually, I have to look that up because I'm not sure. I'm not going to give you the wrong answer.
I could tolerate the wrong answer. I'm going to guess it's something like 20, 30, 40 kilohertz is the spacing between channels.
Let's see. I'm just looking at the now the AM hybrid IBOC parameters, and there's 25 sub-carriers per sideband on the digital. There's a total of 50 sub-carriers. Frequency spacing from the carrier is 10.36 to 14.72 kilohertz. Now the modulation type today is 64 QAM, sorry. The data rate is today 51.96 kilobits per second. Let's see, coding rate, or the FEC, if you want to call it that, is 5 over 12. And, let me drop. Actual throughput in kilobits is 20.19. Total power per sideband for a 50 kilowatt station is 1,256 watts. Total power of both sidebands is minus 13 dBc, and the total power for both sidebands of a 50 kilowatt station is 2,512 watts. And that's in the primary. Okay, as you get further away, you can actually go to lower and lower rates. Let me see. Primary IBOC data service case, station information, time of day, all that data stuff. What we normally think about is RDBS. And I'm looking at a spectral power density. And the FCC math says it's a total of plus and minus 15 kilohertz wide, so that makes it 30 kilohertz.
WB2HWW with a question on this.
I would recognize. Yeah, I think there's a station on the dial at 700 and there's another station at 730, so maybe the 30 kilohertz separated right now. WB2HWW, K2IW. Go ahead, Howie.
Hi, WB2HW. The question is for Eric. Eric, in the United States, when you get into a car, your digital radios in the 90s would be, you know, 880, 890, 900. When I went to Europe, I spent several months over there. The first time I got into a car and started tuning around on the AM broadcast band, I noticed that in Europe the spacing on the radio for 9 kilohertz station, like 880, 889, 998, and so on. Can you tell me why they ran with 9 kilohertz and we had 10 kilohertz of spacing? 10 kilohertz, like 880, 710, you know, 720, and so on. Yeah. They may be spaced far enough apart so they don't interfere with each other, but there were basically 10 kilohertz channels. But I noticed that in Europe, in the AM broadcast band, in the regular, you know, 540, the medium band, not low band, not super low, but regular broadcast band, in Europe they were 9 kilohertz. Can you explain to me, do you know why they went with a different format than we did? Was it just politics? Nobody was ever able to tell me the reasons for that.
Yeah, this is a W1QIY.
You want to see what the W1 station has to say first?
Okay, while you're looking that up, Whiskey 1, Quebec, India, Yankee, question mark. Please tell us your name, and then proceed with your question or comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, the call is W1QIY. I have a question. What is this really in New York City and is on the 85 repeater in New York? Over to you, W1QIY.
W1QIY, K2RIW. Yes, this is in New York City. This is the so-called LIMOC repeater, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. And let's see, you're in Massachusetts, Joel, and you're probably listening to us on either Echo Link or IRLP. Is that true, Joel? W1QIY, K2RIW.
Yeah, all I know is I'm on W2KL repeater, and on your repeater on I'm on the Echo Link, so yeah, some of the repeaters you can get on Echo Link too, and yeah, I'm on the Echo Link on your side. So actually, you sound pretty nice and clear audio, and I used to listen to you guys on A5 repeater when it was the band opening, but I don't really hear you guys anymore. So I don't know, it doesn't get into New York anymore. So back to you, it's everyone QIY.
Yeah, the local LIMOC repeater, Whiskey 2, Victor Lima, is on 146.85, and been around since, the late 60s, I believe, is when it came about. So it's been on for 40 some odd years, 45, 47 years, something like that. Still exists. It's a little bit left of center of Long Island is where it's located, right on the border between Nassau County and Suffolk County is where it's located. And so depending on propagation and how high your antenna is, the A1 Victor Hotel on the Massachusetts-Vermont border, because he's using a great big high tower and a Yagi antenna, he hears us 80% of the time by direct RF path. So depending on where your antenna is located and what your local terrain is like, depends on whether or not you're going to be getting all of that signal. You're located, according to my rundown from QRZ.com, you're 150 miles away from this repeater. So that's pretty far, unless you've got a pretty fancy antenna. 150 miles is a hard thing to cover. Let me drop. And what you're listening to is something that occurs every Sunday night starting at 8 o'clock called the Technical Net, which has been around for 35 plus years. When it comes to spacing of channels, which is Howie's question, Europe has got their spacing for AM, we've got our spacing, they've got their spacing for television. Our television channels used to be all 6 megacycles spaced, I think those are all 8. So each individual entity makes their own choices as to what they think is the ideal number of lines. They use 625 lines, we use 525 lines back in the old amplitude modulation days. They use 8 megs of bandwidth of their television channels, we use 6. So nothing has to be the same. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
I think N2EO, could you put me down if there's time?
Roger, go ahead, Eric.
KQRIW, K2EJ. It turns out in Europe and Asia, 9 kilohertz steps was the standard. The reason for that was a little bit less of the broadcast band was available just after World War II. And they wanted it to be able to stuff some more channels in there. So it wasn't technical. It was purely by law. The Geneva Convention actually set it up as 9 kilohertz is the worldwide standard. And we decided to go 10 kilohertz when we set up our standard. And actually, New Zealand and Australia was originally 10 kilohertz, but in 1980 they went to 9 kilohertz. And now, of course, that we're doing stereo, and they're doing stereo, that's all changed. And by the way, many places in Europe now do not have any more AM broadcasting.
And name a couple of places where AM broadcasts cease to exist. Is it the major countries like United Kingdom, France, Germany? Is it the major countries that get rid of AM broadcasts? Eric, go ahead.
Let me see. I believe in Europe they're in the process of removing AM broadcasting. And the reason for that is they're very big on DAB, the digital audio broadcasting, which runs, I think it's around 1.2 gigs, a little bit higher than that.
Is that 1.2 gigs over the air broadcast and not satellite? And do they have an FM band like ours? Our FM band goes from 88 to 108 megs. Does Europe have a similar frequency region where FM over the air broadcast takes place? Eric, go ahead.
Well, Europe has a demand for a lot more frequencies simply because they have a lot more countries and a lot of smaller states. Lower power outputs than we have. Give me another minute while I take another look here.
Sure,
amazing.
Yeah, the other question is, Eric, I think in Europe we run 75 kilohertz of deviation on FM, and I think they run 50 kilohertz. Because when I brought over an FM radio, I think the audio is just a little bit lower. But a lot of radios could handle the differences. I think the spacing on FM is different than ours. So, but that was the first thing I remembered, Dick, is when I got out of the airport and we went to the car, and I traveled to some places that were pretty unusual. We were in Bulgaria, Romania, but I spent most of my time in Greece. But I do remember back then, 9KC, then I asked a couple of broadcast engineers, and they just say that's just the way it was. I couldn't believe the fact that, you know, we ran with 10 and they ran with 9 kilohertz. But they have a lot of medium wave, a lot of 200, 300 kilohertz. I wonder what they're doing with all of that spectrum in the, you know, in the broadcast band from 500 on up. I wonder what it was. And I will tell you that once or twice, Dick, at night, at 1, 2 o'clock in the evening, I was able to hear 880 out of New York on a very quiet night. There was snow outside in the middle of the night. I have actually heard 880, very noisy, but I've heard clear stations out of the United States.
FM broadcasting in Europe is 50 kilohertz, which makes it 100 kilohertz wide. We do 150 kilohertz in terms of occupying space. There's some obsolete FM standards, which are 500 and 300 kilohertz. What else? The emphasis is different. We use 75 microseconds. They use 50 microseconds. Their stereo carriers are on different frequencies. Their SDAs are on different frequencies. What else? They also have, their band runs a little bit differently than ours. So, different countries took originally different standards. The UK runs from 88 to 94. Then they extended it to 108. Most of Europe is 97. Oh, that's wrong. That's history. A lot of different things happen in different places. Regional broadcasters still commonly operate AM stations due to the additional range, but many centers are using digital radio, so the DAB standard's been rolled out in most cities. Then there's a lot of difference to, let's see. Some countries that have switched off FM and gone to DAB. Let me stop.
Hey, Eric, what do you think is going to happen to those spectrum? What do you think is going to happen to the 88 to 108 in Europe? And what do you think is going to happen to the AM broadcast band? Do you think that will be used for something else?
About the offset.
Yeah, Eric and Howie doubled. But 88 to 108 is what some of Europe is now. Eric, could I go out and buy a software-defined radio for FM AM for FM broadcast, over-the-air broadcast, covering roughly 88 to 108 megs, and therefore, because it's a software-defined radio, I could I could set its mode of operation for United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, and so on. Has somebody like Samsung or any other company like that made a software-defined radio that's adaptable to all of these crazy standards for stereo in Europe as well as the United States? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RW, K2J. Yeah, well, if you were to go to the European and the Asian market, you'll be able to find radios that pick up multiple standards. Interestingly enough, in the UK, the BBC began FM broadcasting in 55, years 88 to 94. Subband of 94.6 to 97 was used by the BBC and local commercial services. However, when commercial broadcasting was introduced in 73, use of FM picked up in Britain with the gradual change, the extension gradually went to 108. In 80 and 95, it expanded, effectively took over long wave to medium wave as a delivery platform of choice. They restricted licenses for local coverage. Got a weird way of doing things here. Eventually, in 1987, the frequency range of 97 to 99 was allocated as police relay transmitters. They were moved from 100 megahertz, and starting in London, being broadly completed by 1989. Isn't that weird?
When it comes to FM broadcast, each country has a slightly different standard of deviation, maximum for deviation ratio, stereo standards, and so on. However, I noticed that all of them seem to almost end at 108. And when it comes to air-to-ground and ground-to-air aircraft communication, 108 to 120, I'm going to call it. 108 to 122, something like that.
136, actually.
Okay, 136. I'd like to believe that is an international standard, because those aircraft fly to all of those countries. I'd like to believe that aircraft amplitude modulation, air to ground and ground to air, I'd like to believe that is a worldwide standard. Is that roughly true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
That's definitely true. There is actually a couple of oddball frequencies that are used for over the ocean. I think there's some at 18 megahertz. They have some low frequency stuff, sideband stuff. Interestingly enough, Japan uses for FM broadcast, they run from 76 to 95. The Soviet bloc runs from 87 to 108. Some of the older frequencies are used from 65 to 74, and the assigned frequencies are an interval of 30 kilohertz, being phased out of most countries. They got a lot of strange stuff going on over there.
Good stuff. So the one place where amplitude modulation is still being used is aircraft. To my knowledge, aircraft communication is not FM. They want amplitude modulation because they don't want the capture ratio. If two aircraft guys talk on top of each other, I think the ground wants to hear both of those conversations. Is that part of the reason they chose AM, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, and also their standards move very slowly?
As far as I know, that's absolutely correct, Dick. They want to hear everything, so. I'm looking to see which countries are actually removing AM broadcasting and FM broadcasting and going purely into the digital stuff.
You said they used 18 megacycles or some other crazy frequency for over the ocean. I'd like to believe that a number of the high-class aircraft are going from aircraft to satellite when they're over an ocean to give continuous communication. Is there any truth in that? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
There are airline companies that use satellites. They use Inmarsat and a couple of others for corporate, inter-corporate communication, but as far as the aircraft standards, they're going to the NASA-developed system, which is part of the navigation system, but not the communication system, as far as I know at this point.
KM4KPV for comment.
And it's called ADSB.
Okay, the person making comment, it sounded like Alpha Mike 4, Kilowatt Papa Victor. Please start off with your name and then your comment, sir. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Kilo Mike 4, Kilo Papa Victor, KM4KPV. David, I just had coffee with a UPS pilot just yesterday. We were actually talking about this. And for international travel over the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean and so on, they actually use HF. And they have three VHF radios on board and then two HF radios. So it's just backed up and backed up and backed up. But he specifically said that. And you're right, they're also using satellites to communicate with their company, and they're required under FAA law in the United States, their commercial carriers have direct contact essentially with their company and their boss. Over.
David, is that direct contact with their company and their boss by way of satellite? Could that possibly be an Inmarsat satellite? Back to you, David, in Lexington, Kentucky.
That's a good question. I think it's not Inmarsat. I think it's something else. Next time we as a group gather for coffee at a coffee shop, we try every Saturday at about 8:30 in the morning, and Jeff's usually there, so I'll definitely ask him. And next time there's a TechNet, I'll have an answer for you. Over.
Very fine, David. We're looking forward to that answer from Kentucky. I think it's possibly by Echolink. I know that I can't think of his call letters. Howie, you had a question where you doubled and maybe your question didn't get answered. Over to you, Howie, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's taking me a couple of seconds to translate here, Dick. I'm on Echolink. No, I think everything was answered. I was just asking, Eric, what do you think is going to happen to all of those frequencies they're getting rid of? And it was amazing traveling throughout Europe seeing the difference. Believe it or not, I think Bulgaria and Albania were using some 43 megahertz stuff for FM broadcast. It was just amazing to see the differences between different countries. And it's all political. I mean, basically, they want to make sure that people don't hear other stuff from other countries. That's really what it was. You know, that was from the good old days of the Cold War, probably. So I'm just wondering, what's going to happen to all of these frequencies? What are they going to use them for? Especially the 500 to 1600 kilohertz band. I wonder where that's going to go. What use they will put that to once they get all the AM stuff off, all the commercial broadcasting.
You've got it, Eric.
I don't have an answer for that. It's a good question. I can probably find out. Just searching through some of this stuff here. Countries have different limits on their bands, although they typically use the same deviation standard, but they also have different pilot frequencies for stereo, and they have different channel spacing. And the Chinese is going to expand its FM band down to 64 megahertz. Europe, Algeria, and Mongolia broadcast AM also from 153 to 279 kilohertz at 9 kilohertz increments. Japan is 76 to 90 at 100 kilohertz increments. And Russia and some of the former Soviet Union broadcast from 65 to 74 megahertz, 30 kilohertz. So that's all different. And France uses in the AM frequencies down at the bottom, from 840 to 1000. So there you go. as far as what they're going to do as they vacate, I don't have an answer for you.
When it comes to FM broadcast pre-emphasis, which really means the higher frequencies are transmitted with greater volume than the lower frequencies, because an FM discriminator at thresholds makes high frequency hiss. So by pre-emphasizing the higher frequencies and then de-emphasizing it on reception, you get rid of some of that hiss and it sounds better. When they talk about 75 microseconds of pre-emphasis, when it comes to pre-emphasis, the pre-emphasis has a certain volume increase and a certain roll-off frequency or rate of volume increase. I think the highest frequency we transmit of audio on FM broadcast is 15 kilohertz. So with 75 microseconds of pre-emphasis, does that mean that a 15 kilohertz sine wave coming into the microphone ends up 75 microseconds advanced in phase because of the pre-emphasis network? Is that what the word 75 microseconds means, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
That's basically right, Dick. Although I've seen here that some countries now use DBX instead of pre-emphasis. DBX is it's sort of like Dolby, but they break it up into different bands. If you look at an RIAA curve for 75 microseconds, you see that there's sort of a line that starts to grow beginning around 3 kilohertz and makes its way up to 15 kilohertz.
Yeah, it sounds like the 75 microseconds has only one definition of the way you build that circuit. And I'm guessing the 75 microseconds is the amount of advance at a 15 kilohertz signal. And then I presume the RIAA curve or whatever it is, I presume it rolls off extremely rapidly beyond 15 kilohertz. Is that true, K2RIW?
Sorry, Dick, repeat the question.
Does the audio that's broadcast on FM over-the-air broadcast, it's got a rising waveform up to 15 kilohertz, but then does it have an extremely sharp roll-off beyond 15 kilohertz? Over to you, Eric.
You know, it's a requirement, because you don't want to step on the next station, the next channel up.
But how much you step on the next station up is a function of modulation index. So that I don't have to roll off super fast, and yet the sidebands are going to roll off very fast, I think. But we won't get into that. Okay.
Yeah, there's filters in the transmitter to prevent you from going too far. And actually, a lot of transmitters will have notch filters on both sides.
Notch filters with a notch at roughly what frequency, Eric?
Well, your carrier frequency plus 75 kilohertz on one side, minus 75 kilohertz on the other.
If I'm notching at 75 kilohertz...
Let's call it a band stop filter. All right.
Roger, Dodger. Okay. So that the adjacent channel power ratio probably has an FCC requirement of minus 40 dB or some number like that.
There's actually a specification for the shoulders of how fast it has to roll off. Like, I know the numbers, but I should know the FM numbers, but I don't. Like for my ATSC, 8BSB transmitter, it's got to be a minimum 47 dB. Actually, the numbers that we're looking for are like 52. And that's at, I think that's at, 47 dB. Over carrier at plus 3 megahertz and minus 3 megahertz. That's something that we've got to adhere to. But with the digital broadcasting now, it's actually a little bit wider. So what we're actually doing now is you're forcing, if you were transmitting IBOP, you actually have to reduce your main deviation of your mono or your stereo carrier, so is that you don't bang into the digital stuff.
When it comes to Advanced Television Selection Committee, ATSC 3, the new high-definition television over the air broadcast. Rough guess, Eric. When is that actually going to become quasi popular? I think you're saying they're already using it in Japan. But when are we really going to?
I think it's Korea.
Okay, Korea. Probably South Korea. When are we going to see purchasable televisions and on-the-air broadcast in, say, the New York City area? Will that take place roughly 2 years from now? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
WD2XWW.
Yeah, we're expecting the FCC to do a final order, and it's going to be before the end of the year. So probably sometime in December, the format will become law, and we've got a lot of, I think there's 16 clear channel stations ready to turn the switch on. So in New York, I wouldn't be surprised if the first one comes up sometime in January or February.
Now, is it sort of like software-defined radio? You just change the program, and the new format is there. That's one approach. Or has brand-new hardware been created? The brand-new hardware has been produced and installed, and they're ready to just flip the switch. You make it sound like it's a second. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, interestingly enough, we just bought 3 new Rosen Schwartz transmitters to replace our existing transmitters. And the equipment's all ready. It's all there. It's just a matter of flipping your encoder to the other format. As far as to produce content and that sort of stuff, all that's up to the individual station. But the hardware is already being produced and being delivered.
Has Channel 13 and Channel 21 already had the hardware produced, hardware delivered, and done a 3 o'clock in the morning test to confirm that it's ready to roll, and all you got to do is flip the switch? Is that roughly where you are already, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Now, the interesting part about the Rode transmitters is that they basically make one piece of hardware, and the hardware, depending upon what options you buy, which are just software licenses, the transmitter will produce ATSB, ATSC3. They also sell the same transmitter as an FM radio transmitter, also as a DAB for Europe, and also transmits DVB-T, and it transmits analog TV. How's that grab you?
That Rode & Schwartz company must be making a fortune. Are they the number one producer of this hardware right now, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, let's put it this way. They're not the only one, but the interesting thing is, since we're public radio, and now, for the past couple of years, everything that we do has to go out for bid, they seem to come up with the best prices.
Rode & Schwartz is a very respected German company, but I'll bet you their hardware is designed in Germany, but being reproduced in, being manufactured in Southeast Asia. Is that possible, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, if you said that to their face, they would become very insulted. They are, their plants own half of Munich. Everything they make is made in Germany. And my boss actually went to tour the factory, and they make more stuff than you can possibly imagine.
So how in the world is Germany doing their own manufacture, and the rest of the world allowed Southeast Asia to do the manufacture? What has Germany discovered that the United States on that area has not discovered? Over to you, Eric.
All right, well, let me tell you that the company that has made the equipment that I'm currently using now, actually, most of their stuff is made in Massachusetts. Although the particular run of transmitter that I have in this particular location speaks French, because the company was bought by, well, the company changed hands a number of times. Now, actually, the company that manufactures the transmitter I had,
was bought by Hitachi. It was actually for many, many, many years a company called Comar, which is totally manufactured in Massachusetts. Their new products have been